There's nothing like sinking into luxury. Anabe sofas combine ultimate comfort and design at an affordable price. Anabe has designed the only fully machine washable sofa from top to bottom. The stain-resistant performance fabric slipcovers and cloud-like frame duvet can go straight into your wash. Perfect for anyone with kids, pets, or anyone who loves an easy-to-clean, spotless sofa. With a modular design and changeable slipcovers, you can customize your sofa to fit any space and style. Whether you need a single chair, love seat, or a luxuriously large sectional, Anabe has you covered. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your home. Sofas start at just $699. And right now, get early access to Black Friday savings, up to 60% off store-wide with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Add a little to your life. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Movie Buff Specialist Phil and John are back as we continue making our way through our favorite 100 movies of all time. Episode number 62 today, and we are into the 30s. Number 39. We're talking Before Sunset from me. John had Rosemary's Baby, but I have Rosemary's Baby even higher on my list. So we're going to be talking about a different Polanski movie, his first English language film, which is Repulsion, which I learned this week is very difficult to get into a voice-activated remote. Every time I would hear Repulsion, the potion, the ocean, reopen, I could not get it. It took me forever, and it was annoying because I'd watched it, paused it, gone to get something to eat, come back. And when I came back, like all I'd done was take something out of the oven, but it just was long enough. And when I came back, it had gotten rid of it. So I had to speak into the remote again, and it could not for the life of me understand what I was trying to say. So hopefully you all do, although I'm not quite sure I understand what Roman Polanski was trying to say with Repulsion. So anyway, these are the two movies you're talking about. Richard Linklater's sequel to the Before trilogy, or the second installment in the Before trilogy, and Repulsion replacing Rosemary's Baby. John, how's it going?
It's going well. I watched a lot of Richard Linklater this week. Kind of just spiraled into that. So it was a good week.
Nice. Anything worth noting, or are we going to wait?
Not really.
Nice. Okay. So that's that. All right. Well, we're obviously not going to start with Before Sunset because people actually have seen that movie. Repulsion being the first movie of Roman Polanski's to come out in the English language. I think this is the first. Is this the first Polanski we're actually talking about? I know I have Chinatown and The Pianist and Rosemary's Baby all in coming weeks. So I do have three Polanski movies in, I think, my top 35-ish. So
now the Pianist is actually next week. So we're just starting our Polanski roll this week. But yeah, this is the first Polanski film we're actually talking about.
That's crazy. Okay. Yeah. One of my all-time favorite directors. And, you know, we talked about it a lot last week, John, but you know, another person where you really have to separate the human from the art. And I mean, I'll tell you what, it's obviously every documentary tries to push you in a certain direction or not, but watch Polanski Wanted and Famous or something like that, whatever it was. It's a messed up documentary and it's definitely pushing for its agenda. However, it's still an interesting watch because it's interesting to see a documentary try to take the stance of almost defending Polanski. Very interesting documentary. It came out on HBO probably about a decade ago now, but worth a watch. And I mean, remember Meryl Streep got on stage after she won an Oscar at some point. I think she accepted on behalf of Polanski for The Pianist and said that we need to forgive him. So, you know, who knows what's going on in people's minds, but you know, it's Hollywood. So, you know, we can't really say that they're overly against these kinds of people. However, interesting documentary to watch, but tell me about why you picked Repulsion to replace Rosemary's Baby. I don't think it's hard to figure out why.
Yeah. I mean, when replacing Rosemary's Baby, I thought it was really important to kind of focus on the ideas Polanski's putting forward in Rosemary's Baby. So I chose the first of his so-called apartment trilogy, which is not an official trilogy at all, but they're similar tonally, and that's Repulsion, Rosemary's Baby, and The Tenant. And the big thing here is Polanski's use of the environment to really reflect the diminishing mental state of our protagonists in these films. And that is, absolutely happens in Repulsion. When we meet Carol, she's such an innocent and shy character. She isn't forceful at all. She's very, what's the word I'm looking for? I don't want to say like servitude or anything like that, but she's very much, she'll do whatever she's told for the most part. And as we progress through the film and we see her becoming more paranoid, becoming more fearful, and we see the apartment changing to reflect that mentality, it really is one of these traits that Polanski really does deliver on in this trilogy of films.
Yeah, so I've never seen The Tenant, believe it or not. Now I've seen pretty much, I've seen most of Polanski's movies now, though, after seeing Repulsion, because I hadn't seen Tess. I got around to watching Tess. I've seen, you know, obviously seen all of his classics. I saw Knife in the Water this year. So I've gotten around to seeing a lot of Polanski. I thought that this movie had a lot of strong moments, but ultimately felt like a director still trying to find where he was going. And I'm not surprised that this isn't one of his bigger hits, that it's not one of the movies that like is most, you know, The Pianist, Rosemary's Baby, Chinatown, to me, those are the three movies you should be talking about when you're talking about Roman Polanski. Knife in the Water is a close four. And then everything after that, it all kind of muddles together a little bit. I was really into the idea of this movie. I liked the house falling apart. It had like a, you could see where Darren Aronofsky got inspiration for Mother from this movie, mm-hmm. like a lot with the house and things like that, or the Coen brothers with Barton Fink, which isn't really a horror movie, but kind of delves in these similar situations of what's real, what's not, where are they? Everything's falling apart. My biggest knock on it, and it shouldn't be my biggest knock, but I just don't feel that her motivation was explored enough. I understand that she just does not like men. Some would say she's repulsed by men. Interesting. Huh? We could get a movie title out of this.
Cool.
But I just wanted a little bit more of like what happened to her to make her hate these men so much. What was going on in her life? Because I mean, there's some creepy moments in this. I mean, the dream rape scenes are horrifying, which we see probably the most terrifying one of all time in Rosemary's Baby. Not saying that there's many of them, but it's funny to watch these two build to what Rosemary's Baby becomes, which is honestly maybe one of the greatest scenes in film history, as messed up as it is. But the devil impregnating scene is ridiculous in that movie. I just think like, this didn't quite get there. I liked it. I enjoyed a lot of moments of it. I thought it was a fun movie for the most part, but it just was discombobulated for a lot of it for me. But again, you didn't have it on your top 100. You just replaced it here. But in terms of Polanski movies, definitely goes towards the bottom of the well-regarded Polanski movies that I've seen.
Definitely. And that's kind of part of the reason why I really wanted to bring it up this week too, because my introduction to Repulsion was I was skimming through the internet for like lists of best horror movies or horror movies you have to see, and Repulsion kept coming up on them and rather high on these lists too. So I really needed to give it a try, and it's a tough movie to watch. It's a very heavy subject matter, obviously. And the fact that you never really know if anything happens with these, like these dream sequences, is like, are these real? Did this happen? And that's why Carol's responding this way. Is this all in her imagination? What's taking her to that limit? It is, as you said, like I enjoy this movie quite a lot. I think it's like a 3.5 movie for me. I know you gave it 3 stars. It is missing that one little bit to show the motivation behind the character.
Yeah, that was my biggest complaint. And because of that, with it being such a weird concept of like this, it's this movie about a woman who just hates men, like just hates being around them, but not in like an outward, like you think about it, if this movie was made in 2022, it would dive into every political issue that, you know, like really, really, really feminist people believe that they would go in on the men for. This doesn't do that. And I almost wish it would have done a little bit of it. We see that she's a manicurist. She works in a beauty salon. Like she does all of those things. She lives with her sister, but this first guy doesn't do anything to her. Until
as later far as in the we movie. Know. Yeah.
Yes. But if he did, I want more hints that he did. Like, it's
it was
a very weird choice to just be like, no, because at first I was like, oh, she's just socially awkward. Like, whatever. We've seen this kind of thing. And then it becomes like, well, no, now she's killing these guys. And like, why? And maybe it's read between the lines. Maybe that's what it's trying to get you to do. But even to read between the lines, I need more context to know what I'm supposed to be reading.
Yeah, it's really hard to dissect because Polanski leans so much into symbology in this film and symbolism. Like, it's so hard to just determine what exactly he's trying to get at. And like, maybe that's because it's the transition into his first English language film.
Mm-hmm.
Because like, even like the dialogue in the film feels a little disjointed at times, but it's just missing something that explains it all.
Mm-hmm.
And if it had that explanation, this could be an absolutely incredible film.
Yeah, I agree. But some really good moments. I thought the mm-hmm. moment where she kills the landlord, I thought that was a great moment. I thought the first moment where she actually attacks Colin, I think his name was, or something like that, mm-hmm. when she attacks him, thought that was a really good moment. I like when she rips the lady's skin off. You know, that's always fun. The rabbit in this is disgusting, and it's always there. And that's like one of the like hardest things to look at, but you're always constantly having to look at it. So like, I was a big fan of a lot of that. I like too, if you notice, 95 to 100% of the people that appear outside of her comfort zones, like when she's out on the streets walking, are men. Almost every single one of them is a man, and they're always walking at her for the most part. Mm-hmm. They're always coming towards her, and it's like there's nothing she can do to avoid it. So I like those little touches. You can see, because you have to think, this is Polanski's first English language film. 3 years later, he makes Rosemary's Baby. 7 years later, he makes 9 years later, he makes arguably the greatest film noir in the history of film with Chinatown. Yeah. So he wasn't far off from getting there. It was just like, there are some really, really good stuff. And I still wonder, how does he do that stuff with the wall? How is he doing like all of that? Like, there's some really good moments in this with like camera tricks and special effects. You got to remember, it's 1965. It might seem like, oh, that's pretty easy, but what was he doing to make this work? I think it's pretty interesting to see what he was capable of, especially since his movies later on in his career, very rarely are they heavy on any type of special effect or any type of any of this stuff. Think about Rosemary's Baby, doesn't really have it. The Pianist, you know, typical war special effects, nothing really more than that. Carnage, you just sit down and talk. Chinatown, almost no special effects the whole movie. I wonder why he went this route and why he didn't continue to go this route.
Yeah, it's really interesting because like these special effects are so in camera and so they seem so subtle. Like the cracking of the walls in the apartment. I don't even know. I mean, somebody out there obviously does know, but maybe somebody could enlighten us as to how you would get that type of effect to show on camera like that. And to like crack like that, because it's so effective, because it just shows this deteriorating mental state that Carol's going through from this presumed trauma that she's experienced.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it does a really good job of getting into the mental state. And you can see how this movie is an inspiration for a lot of these claustrophobic psychological thrillers that came later. I mean, I just saw this for the first time. It wasn't like I'd never heard of this movie though, and now all of a sudden I'm discovering it. Like Queen Margot was something I never heard of, and then my friend just said, hey, you gotta watch this movie. I watched it, I was like, holy shit. But Repulsion I've heard of, and maybe it's just because Polanski's attached to it, but that also makes it easier for these like film fanatics, for these up-and-coming directors, people who want to be auteurs, who generally, these indie directors start with horror. It's the easiest thing to get into. It's the easiest thing to begin your career with because you can show off your technique and your skill without having to do it for a good budget. And people don't really care if the acting is good. That's why that works.
Yeah.
I actually found the acting to be quite good in this movie, though. Mm-hmm. But all that's just to say, like, I was very into like those techniques, the wall and just like, you know, even when the guy gets thrown into the bathtub is leaking. Like there were just some moments in this that were really well executed. And yeah, it's not hard to see how this would inspire so many movies that came after it that are like, hey, we're going to be low budget. We're going to be set in a house or a hotel room or whatever. We see it all the time. This is a classic horror movie trope.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, Alex Garland's making a movie that seems pretty reminiscent of Repulsion that's coming out this month. And it's interesting to see how this trope of this like isolated woman alone in an apartment is just has been perpetuated over the years and continues to live on. It's interesting because it kind of has this like subtle supernatural element to it with like the apartment deterioration and like how it's falling apart. Obviously not as like obvious as the supernatural element in Rosemary's Baby, but it's interesting how that is often, and historically, I'm speaking historically here, that's how a lot of trauma women experience is portrayed in film and literature, mm-hmm. right? Like this is what happened. If let's look at like what happens to Carol after this moment, right? They probably put her in a mental institution, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, you're and not like putting her in jail.
No, and like that's the historical response to women who respond like this to a traumatic event. And like, yes, we don't know if the traumatic event in this movie actually happens. There's a lot of hints that it certainly does.
Mm-hmm.
But that's also what I think really pays off with the way that Polanski shows it. Because then we're now questioning. It's like, what's reality? What isn't reality? What's just inside Carol's head? The landlord scene, when the landlord comes in, he goes so long without acknowledging the rabbit that's right there.
Yeah.
You just start believing, is the rabbit there? Like, or is this all in her head?
Yeah.
It's fascinating what Polanski brings to just make you doubt your understanding of everything in this movie.
Yeah. And I was under the impression, I almost wish that we didn't have the ending. If that makes sense too. I feel like with the ending, it does tie it up in a way where it gets rid of those questions, because I believe that all the stuff with the guy barging in and breaking into her room and blah, 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 that stuff. Okay. That's all a dream. Then I'm saying, well, is the stuff with Colin a dream? Is the stuff with the landlord being made up because she hears the landlord talking to her sister? She hears the way the landlord talks to other people. Is this kind of like just happening in her mind? So I was a little disappointed when it was very clearly drawn out as no, it was done. And I almost wish we would have seen the landlord and they would have walked into the bathroom and the guy wasn't there. Because then I say to myself, well, wait a second. Did she kill Colin? Did she not kill him? Also, like, is this just her imagining? Is it not? The landlord, you know, kind of deserves it at the point where she kills him. Like, you know, at that point, it's like, whatever, do what you gotta do. But we don't see a reason for Colin to be killed in this movie. And I also liked one of my favorite scenes in this, and it's so, so reminiscent of Rosemary's Baby, which obviously he hadn't made yet. But when they're arguing and the lady is standing out in the hallway, just staring at them, such a great scene. Cause that was another part where I'm like, wait, now when they go talk to that lady, if she says, well, I don't know what you're talking about, all of a sudden I'm like, well, wait, she was standing there. Was she watching her yell at herself? Like all that. But it cuts a lot of those questions out because it is so neatly tied up. And I also wonder how much of that just had to do with the fact that it's 1965 and he's making this as an American movie. There's really, you can't leave things as open-ended when you're making an American movie. We talked about that with The Descent last week. Mm-hmm. It's hard to do that. So I'm just very curious what happened with that. And, you know, if it would have been different, had it been made in, you know, Poland or something like that, because Knife in the Water doesn't have a very clean ending. It's not like this, but it doesn't have a very clean ending. And I just think that, you know, I just thought that this one shouldn't have either.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we are never shown Colin's body at the end, right? Mm-hmm. When everyone comes into the apartment, we there's an assumption of it because they go into the bathroom and say, oh my God. And like the heavy gas and everything. But based on their positioning with the bathroom, they could still be looking into the bedroom where Carol is, like, under the bed.
That's true.
So, like the Colin of it is still a little ambiguous. Obviously, the landlord's not, because that body is very clearly under a Chesterfield in the in the
living room. That one they don't leave open to interpretation.
No, and I think that's fine, because the whole landlord character was so fascinating to me, because he was so rude and abrasive on the phone all the time. Clearly, like, thinks little of Carol and Helen because they're foreigners. And as soon as Carol presents the rent money, his whole demeanor changed. And it's like, oh, maybe this guy's not so bad. And he, like, seems like he's taking care of Carol at that part. And then it starts going on to him, the, you know, being, you know, a bad person. And it was just a transition. And then we finally, and then we're like, yeah, we want Carol to kill this man by the time she does. Yeah. It's a very well acted scene where, like, the transition is just so instantaneous from upset about everything, but upset about being barred out, upset about not having the rent, to, oh, I have the rent, I have nothing to be upset about anymore. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, oh, you look sickly, let me help. And then it, you know, slowly progresses into that more and more creepy zone. And it comes back to that photo of the family.
Very
terrifying. Photo. So creepy.
And what is she looking at, you know?
And why is she so distant and out there? I mean, it's these little hints that, like, Carol was abused as a child, right? But it's never fully stated. Roman Polanski leaves that up for interpretation. But, like, this distant look is the same look we see on Carol the entire time.
Yeah, and I don't need it completely spelled out. I just wish there would have been a little bit more of something. Because I agree. Like, that photo is very creepy. It lets you know something's not right with her. Something's not right with how she is with her, you know, family. Something's not right with how she grew up. Like, you get all of that information from this. I just wish that they would have went a little bit further with it just to give us a little bit more. I just feel like that would have been helpful, because it's a creepy picture. Yeah, for sure. But I didn't have enough of investment in what that ending meant by the time the ending came.
Yes, that's true. And it's really hard because Carol spends so much of this movie alone that we don't have dialogue to explain certain responses she has either. And, like, I'm not saying dialogue's necessary to understand these things. Trust me, next week's movie is a silent movie. Dialogue is not necessary, but it would have helped a little. It's like those moments of, like, peering out through the window at the yard below where all the women are and everything. It just felt like there was one thing missing there to kind of link everything together.
Yeah. And either way, good that Polanski was able to make his way to American audiences. Mm-hmm. Nobody in this movie really ever went on to do much. It's not like any of these people were like big actors, but it was good that he was able to make his way, not even so much to American audiences, but, like, just to English language audiences. Because like, you think about it, he could have went the Ingmar Bergman route, which there's really no problem with Ingmar Bergman. I love Ingmar Bergman. However, Ingmar Bergman is so in the art house. Yes. Roman Polanski is not. Roman Polanski was able to start to take those chances and make a movie like The Pianist because of his reputation, because of a movie like Repulsion that got him started and moving in the right direction. So I think that's huge.
Yeah, absolutely. It really did go to show where his artistic vision was and that he still had an understanding of audiences and what audiences responded to.
I agree. Do you want to keep talking Repulsion, or should we find our way?
I do want to mention one last thing, and it's right before we see the third sexual assault after Carol's murdered both Colin and the landlord, and she puts the makeup on.
Yes.
It's such a horrifying and disheartening scene. It's just like she's so prepared for it, and it's the worst sexual assault in the entire film, and it leads us into the ending. It's just repulsive.
Yeah, it is. No, it... Lynch got some inspiration from this movie too. Like, let's be real.
Yeah, definitely.
If David Lynch said I've never seen Repulsion, I'd call him a liar and stop watching his movies, because clearly was inspired by this one right here.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's move past it since it's not one in our top 100. We talked about it for like 20 minutes and, you know, whatever. What was the best thing you watched this week?
Best thing I watched that didn't have Before in the title.
See, that's the part I'm having a hard time too, because it's obviously Before Sunrise. Like, yes, 100%. Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. But give me something else other than Before Sunrise, because we're going to talk about Before Sunrise when we talk about Sunset.
So, like I said, I watched a lot of Linklater this week. I watched 5 of his films. I watched the entire Before trilogy, all of which are absolutely stupendous. I watched School of Rock because I needed something light after watching Before Midnight. And I watched A Scanner Darkly, which is a weird movie. Mm-hmm. That is a weird movie. Interesting though. And then the only other two movies I watched Uncharted and Spider-Man No Way Home. So like the best movie I watched that wasn't part of the Before trilogy has to be School of Rock.
Yeah, and nothing really much to write home about there except for Ned Schneebly, right?
Exactly.
Because it's Mike White. That's all that matters.
Yeah.
Mine, if it's not gonna be Before Sunrise, it's Shrek. I rewatched Shrek this week. Movie's a freaking masterpiece. It's so funny. It's so well done. It's perfectly made. The jokes still hit. I've probably seen that movie 7,000 times, and it just works every single time. It's so freaking entertaining. The voice acting is ridiculous. Like, all the tropes, the way it makes fun of everything, all that stuff. Just so, 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 so well done. Definitely one of those kids' movies that I could sit down and watch every single, like, whenever the hell it's on. It doesn't matter. It doesn't get old. So that's what I got.
Yeah, I mean, I saw you watch it, and I almost put it on right then and there.
Right, it's like, just it's addicting.
The movie has, yeah, it is.
It's just addicting, and the Merry Men scene is just ridiculous. It's so funny. The song. Now that I'm older and I actually understand what he's saying, man, that song is hilarious. All right, let's move on to my number 39, which is Before Sunset. So it's the second installment in the Before trilogy, which people didn't know was going to be a trilogy ever, really. Before Sunrise came out in 1995. Then they waited 9 years and did Before Sunset. And then they waited another 9 years and did Before Midnight. Doesn't look like we're getting a movie in 2022. So it seems like it is just going to be the Before trilogy. I think it would be too depressing to see Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy as 52-year-olds now. I don't need to see that in my life. Let's keep them where they are, young and forever nice. To each other and nice looking. But I picked the second one here, and I rewatched the first two. Before Midnight, I've actually only seen one time. I wanted to watch it again before doing this podcast. I kind of ran out of time. But the reason why, and I've seen Before Sunset and Before Sunrise so many times. The reason I don't go to Before Midnight very often is because it depresses the living shit out of me. It is easily like top 5 most depressing movies I've ever seen in my entire life. And that's why I don't really go back to that one. Mm-hmm. Before Sunrise has that melancholy to it, that melancholy first love, not even first love, but just like a romantic fling and what could have been. There's a hopefulness to it. Before Sunset has what I believe is the greatest ending exchange in movie history. And then you have Before Midnight, which just offers you, look, they're old. And this is where they are. And it's never going to be like it was. And I'm like, well, you know, I don't need that, Richard. Thanks a lot. Let's move on. But I go with Sunset over Sunrise for a couple reasons. First of all, Before Sunrise is going to end up in my top 100. I'm an idiot for not having it in there right now. I just didn't want to have so many two movies in every trilogy that I like in there. But the reason I go with this one is, first of all, I think the story behind it is great. I like that we pick up exactly 9 years later. I think that's a really smart move. I think it's cool that we see Jesse having written this and all that. And now these two characters have moved past this young hopefulness into what have you been doing and how has life kind of beat you down a little bit? And are you happy? I think that's a very fascinating thing. But the reason I picked this one over Sunrise is because Richard Linklater pulls off one of the hardest things to pull off in film and does it so impressively. And that is tell a story in real time.
Mm-hmm.
This movie is 80 minutes long and it takes place over the course of 80 minutes.
Yeah.
We do not jump away from them. There are no cuts in time. Yeah, you can tell that when they walk out of the one cafe that they're not actually walking straight up to that park, but she says, hey, let's go to that park over there. And then he cuts to the top of the stairs and we see them come around a different corner. Yeah, sure. It's not the same corner. However, we are picking up seconds after the conversation stopping. When they're in the car, you hear the voiceover. There are no jumps. That walk up the stairs at the end of the movie, when they're together walking to her apartment, could have easily just jumped to the door. No, this is 80 minutes in the life of Jesse and Celine. How he pulled it off and kept it interesting the entire time and kept me wanting more at the end is brilliant. And I don't know how he did it. And I don't think that any other movie has ever done this successfully. I would say 1917 came very, very close. But I think 1917 has a couple little jumps in there. But this movie, you get zero jumps. It is 80 minutes in the life of these two people. And it's so real. It's so authentic. We hear every single word that they say to each other. We see everything they do that whole time, every step they take. And it all leads to, baby, you're going to miss that plane. It's perfect.
It is. And that's exactly why I find it was the best of the trilogy as well. The fact that this is a real-time film and that Linklater gave us every in-between moment in this film is so impressive, because the conversation, it zigs, it zags. It goes where you expect it to go. It goes places you don't expect it to go. The pacing of the conversation throughout the entire film, it's all completely brilliant, because this is exactly how a conversation between two people who have not seen each other for 9 years, who had one evening or one night, I guess, of just essentially a one-night fling, and now they're reconnecting. And it's so beautiful. It's so brilliant. Ethan Hawke and Julie Duffy are both phenomenal in this. Their chemistry is probably some of the best on-screen chemistry you'll ever see. It's incredible how Linklater was able to just make a movie, just one conversation movie, so engaging.
Yeah, and that's the hardest thing. I mean, you have to think, this is two people. This whole movie is two people. Yeah, there's other people in the background. There's people who ask, what do you want to drink? But it's two people. And it's moving. And I always talk about how in Game of Thrones, they would always talk about with Peter Dinklage, every conversation was his sword fight. You know, because there's all these, so Jon Snow gets sword fights. But Peter Dinklage can't be in a sword fight. So every dialogue that he delivers has to be a sword fight. This movie's a ballet. Because they're not fighting or butting heads. There's no conflict in this movie, if you really think about it. The conflict, and that's what Richard Linklater does better than anything. He makes time the conflict, because in reality, everybody's life, time is the conflict. Yeah, there's going to be other conflicts that come, but all of those conflicts are because of time. Whether you get sick with cancer, or you have a deadline you have to hit, or, oh man, I have to eat, who knows? It's all based on time, because everything is against the clock. And Richard Linklater doesn't have to address that it's all about time. He just lets you know it's all about time. And in this movie, they haven't seen each other in 9 years. They regret it. You know, they talk about it. They're feeling each other out to see where everybody's at. But it's, okay, I'm going to go this way first. And you're going to go this way. And we're going to somehow meet in the middle. And then as soon as we meet, okay, now let's bounce off and let's go back. And it's a dance. It is literally a dance for 80 minutes of these two characters feeling each other out, getting somewhere, almost getting too real. The moment on the park bench, too much familiarity, that type of thing. Him talking about his family at first, his wife and his kid, and, oh, okay, that's great, blah, blah, blah. 10 minutes later, we find out, you know, it sucks. This is terrible. I don't like this. We hear about her relationships, how she feels with the guys in her life. Every time they leave her, then they turn around and they get married and they thank her for it. Like, they're not revealing everything right away. And yet there is so much underlying motivation in these early conversations as they're just feeling each other. Let's go to the cafe a little bit further away. It's nice. You have a little time. Yeah, I got it. I got some time. Let's just go further away so that we can walk and talk. And how do we figure out if we are going to be able to rekindle this relationship we had 9 years ago, which was one night and whatever, but you wrote a story about it. And clearly she goes and writes her song about it. We always love that at the end with Jesse and whatever, but those two things, and it's 80 minutes of just going, bouncing. And then at the end, we see it coming together and we don't know if it sticks or if they bounce off again. And if they never made Before Midnight, we'd still be wondering, did it stick or did it bounce off? We have no idea.
Yeah, it's again, it really falls down into like when they decide to have each of these conversations too. The fact that like either of their relationship status isn't mentioned for 40 minutes, it's because neither of them want to know. Neither of them want the answer to be, yes, I'm in a relationship with someone. Mm-hmm. Right? And it's these little things. It's these little motivations we're seeing in both Jesse and Celine. And as they discuss life and expectations and desire, entitlement, everything under the sun, and like all these great philosophical conversations, when all they really want to know is there even a chance for the two of us?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like they're living in this fantasy world all over again at the beginning, which is, you know, that first conversation they have in Before Sunrise of, you know, do you want to get, you know, they're having coffee, whatever. Do you want to get off this train? Like, get off this train with me. And she gets off the train and they go. And it's like how awkward those conversations are once she does get off the train. Cause now it's like, wait, you're a stranger. I don't know anything about you. This is kind of weird. We're seeing that all over again, but in a different sense, because now they have a shared history, even though it's a very small shared history, but it's so impactful. I love right away. Did you come back in 6 months? No, I didn't come back in 6 months. Did you? Oh, I would have felt terrible. Whatever. 10 minutes later. Of course I was there. Of course. Yeah. And it's those, like, because they don't know each other. While we know, because we watch the movie, we sit down, we watch the movie, and then we watch the next movie. And I didn't watch the first one in 1995. I think I watched them both around like 2007, 2008, 2009, somewhere in that range. I want to say it was probably like right at the beginning of college, because Before Midnight had been announced. And that's why I sat down and watched them. We don't have to wait 9 years in between.
No.
But Linklater does such a good job of creating that idea that there have been 9 years that have passed. Like, I think the decision that Ethan Hawke is married with a kid is such a great decision. It is such a great decision, because now we know when he's sitting there at the end of the movie, he is giving something up for another chance. And some people go, oh, he's a schmuck, whatever. But we are watching him willingly give it up for a missed opportunity that he feels would have been better for him. And as we've seen Before Midnight, it has its positives and its negatives and what happens 9 years after, all that fun stuff. But I just love the way that is addressed. And it's an afterthought. It's Don Draper at the end of the Mad Men finale. He walks in on his family and you're like, wait, this guy has a family? What?
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Yeah. No, it's, I don't know. It's so hard to just like figure out exactly what makes this movie so wonderful, because it simultaneously feels like that idealized romanticism in like Before Sunrise and Before Sunset that's like hit with the hard reality in Before Midnight.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, like, despite how idealized and romanticized it feels, it still feels so authentic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's so believable that this would happen. Like, what are the odds somebody just like, In Before Sunrise, going back to the conversation, the decision of when to have conversations, the fact that they don't introduce themselves until after they're off the train, it's those little things and those little decisions in the scripts that really help elevate these films. I also really love the fact that when we get to Before Sunset, Ethan Hawke and Julie Duffy all both have writing credits now.
Yeah,
and like,
Richard, they had a massive impact on this first one too, though.
Yeah. And it's just like, it really goes to show that this is just a small, this is a super small film, obviously. Before Midnight has the largest cast out of any of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's devastating because of it. Like you said, you don't revisit Before Midnight because that is a very depressing movie. And boy, oh boy, I gave both Before Sunrise and Before Sunset 4.5 stars. And I would have given Before Midnight 4.5. I just could never put it in my top 100 because it's not a movie I can watch over and over again.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, in a lot of these movies, so a lot of what would happen is Linklater would say, this is the point I want you to get to.
Mm-hmm.
Now go. But think about the long takes that are in these movies, that like the level of acting that Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy have. When they're sitting on that train in Before Sunrise, not the original train, but when they're going on the streetcar or whatever.
Yeah.
One take. All right, answer these questions. That's one take. And they're on public transportation. Like, I understand they might have rented something out. But also, what you were saying about the romanticizing of all this, I think that this movie does a great job of capturing the differences between European and American, but how at the same time, the Americans do idealize the European thing. But a lot of the things that Americans think about Europeans are true. Like, in terms of like the more like willing to just talk to anybody and go off on like whatever, and like these one night friendship type things, like, because it's, you know, even if they never slept together, like these one night, I'm just gonna go hang out with these people. It is so much more of a European thing than an American thing, because in America, they're so much more closed off. You're not in our group, get the fuck away from, you know, it's all that stuff. It's very bitter that you're not getting in Europe. And so we have this idyllic guy who is traveling around alone, has just had his heart broken, doesn't have anywhere to go, and it's his last night. And he talks to someone, he says, you know what, why don't you just get off with me? Like, let's go. But then we still see at the end, what's the thing that stops him? His responsibility to go back to America. He has no freaking responsibility in America. Why didn't he just stay? He has nothing to go home to. He tells us that over and over and over again in Before Sunrise. Why is he leaving, and why are they saying, oh, we'll meet up again in 6 months? Why is he ever going?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the American mentality, whereas Julie Delpy is more willing. And then it's funny, he's the one who shows up 6 months later to be there, and she couldn't because of her grandmother, and he gets stood up because he still has that mindset, but he just, you know, he doesn't have, he's still too American at the end of the day. I just think it's a really smart decision by Linklater and a good exploration for sure.
Yeah, it's that decision to Jesse's character is almost it. While he's very like, he waxes poetic and like philosophical a lot of times, he's also very blunt with his deliveries and everything, and like has this form of like realism to him. And that it's that contrast of like the realism approach of Jesse's character to like the more Jesse's the pessimist to Celine's optimist a lot of the time in these films.
So Jesse is the pessimist to Celine's optimism in fantastical situations.
Yes.
She is the pessimist in realistic situations. Does that make sense?
It's
very interesting the dynamic between them. Because she's the one who won't get on a plane.
Yeah.
Because she's scared of dying in the plane, and she's scared of death, and she's scared of all that. But when it comes to these fantastical, you know, oh, you know, here comes the fortune teller. Come on.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to buy like she is the pessimist towards his fantastical ideas, or he's the pessimist and whatever. And she is the one who she can't handle the realistic moments. It's cool, because then at the end of the movie, they're both in a very realistic moment. And that's obviously Sunrise, but you can't really talk about one without talking about the other, which is why we didn't just sit here and say Before Sunrise was the best movie we watched this week other than Before Sunset, because you have to talk about both of them. But I also think that, like, to see where they've changed in their lives, like, think about the character development in this movie. We haven't seen them in 9 years. We get an 80-minute movie where nothing is staged or nothing feels staged. You know what I mean? Like, she meets him. They go for a walk. They go to a cafe. They get up from the cafe. They go for another walk. They get on that boat. The driver drives them back. They get in the apartment, and the movie ends. That is the whole entire movie. That is it. Nothing feels staged. And yet every point that this movie is trying to make is delivered. And that's so hard. Like, that is such a hard thing to do, because we're seeing them what they're not the same as from 9 years ago. Where have they changed? Where have they grown up? Where have they become more bitter? We get the politics of the situation. It's 2004, and they're telling her, you should have a gun. It's New York City and blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, he's making fun of her for being a communist. And, like, we're seeing all that. That wasn't a conversation in the first one. There was nothing about politics in the first one. The first one is all about, you know, where, like, you know, it's those early 20s conversations about life and death and growing older and what we think that's going to mean. And what's our place in this world? And every now and then it'll come up. But once you get into like your early 30s, then it starts to become, well, what is the point? And why is that person feel like they're always attacking me? And why do I feel like I'm always attacking them? And what do I believe in? What do I want to defend? What do I want to do? And we hear Ethan Hawke say that I don't mind getting older because I don't feel like I'm looking forward as much. I can just live in the moment and enjoy it. And this is all happening while he's still saying like, he can't wait to get out of here. He can't wait to go do this. And she calls him on it, but we're seeing the differences are where they think they're maturing, but they're not quite there yet because they don't have the full appreciation. It's just a brilliant dive into that. And the problem for Before Sunset, and I'm saying this now as I'm in the middle of this big speech, the biggest problem for Before Sunset is that it came out the same year as what is probably the greatest American love story ever made. And that's why this movie often gets overlooked when it comes to that, because it was a sequel, number one. It was a shorter, more independent movie. And the other one is much more popular, came out the same year. I think it's the greatest American love story ever made. And that's Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. And that's why a movie like Before Sunset, it was popular, don't get me wrong. But that this one is not in the conversation the same way as a movie like Eternal Sunshine, because Eternal Sunshine is more of that younger, still with that hope, like Before Sunrise. Before Sunrise was kind of ahead of its time. Before Sunset was also ahead of its time. And they just kept coming out ahead of their time 9 years earlier than they showed up or something.
I think what it really comes down to is, I think if I had watched, I'm really glad I watched these now for the first time. Because I'm so much more in a Before Sunset part of my life right now that this movie just hits on a different level. Heck, I'm divorced. I'm in a Before Midnight part of my life right now. Like, these movies hit me so much harder than they would have if I watched them 5 years ago. And I think that's one of the things that you have to appreciate with this. Whereas, like, something like Eternal Sunshine really does kind of more appeal to that romantic youth who, like, you know, are the ones out there buying movie tickets and going to movies and things like that and talking about movies on the internet. Whereas, like, these movies are for people who are that age. Like, I have never seen movies that so perfectly encapsulate the audience they are targeting in their protagonists.
Yeah.
Because Before Sunrise is definitely something for 23-year-olds. That is definitely a movie you watch as someone who's 23 and you're like, yes, this is awesome. This is exactly like, I want to go to Europe and have this one night with someone, this one fantastic night, and just like have this one moment and preserve it forever. And Before Sunset is, I missed an opportunity with that moment. How do I get back to it? How do I move on? Because I know I have this nagging question in me of like, if I had decided to stay at that point, what would have happened? And it's these two people both having that opinion and like battling it out with each other to figure out, because neither of them are willing to just straight up say that's exactly what they're thinking. And Before Midnight is the, oh my God, we made this decision. Was it the right decision? And it's exactly where you're at when you're 23 and 32 and 41 in these type of relationships and these type of moments. It's so reflective of just this generation of people. And I think that's why if you sit someone down, if you sit a 20-year-old down with Before Sunset and Eternal Sunshine, they're probably always going to pick Eternal Sunshine. But I think more times than not, if you set out 30-year-olds like us down, you're going to see more people lean towards Before Sunset than you are Eternal Sunshine.
It was funny because Before Sunset, so both these movies were my, I think, my last iteration of my top 100 whenever I did it. Eternal Sunshine was always in my top five. Like, Eternal Sunshine to me is just a masterpiece. But Before Sunset was way back there in like the 80s or something like that. And then I jumped it all the way up. And I remember when I watched Before Sunset, I watched it maybe 3 years ago. And I remember saying to myself, is this better than Eternal Sunshine? Now, I've also seen Eternal Sunshine 9,000 times. So maybe I'm starting to wear off a bit on that. So that's unfair for me at this point. But it did bring up that question in my mind. And that's why Before Sunset jumped as high as it did in my rankings. What are the romantic movies that I have higher than it? Eternal Sunshine, which is the Before Sunrise of everything, and Blue Valentine, which is the Before Midnight of everything. So I still have my trilogy, essentially. I just have it in a different way. But what I think makes these movies so realistic. So there's a band called the Decemberists. I don't know who listens to them. I don't know, John, if you're familiar with the Decemberists.
I do.
Yeah, they're from Montana, which is pretty much where – that's pretty much Canada. It's Canada. But they have a song called The Engine Driver. And in that song, the one of the lines that comes up over and over – I think it's in the chorus, but whatever – is I've written pages upon pages trying to rid you from my bones. Mm-hmm. This trilogy is that to me. This is Richard Linklater writing – because essentially Ethan Hawke in this movie, he's from Texas. Huh, you know who else was from Texas? Richard Linklater. Like, this is Richard Linklater trying to rid himself of this person that he met. And then Before Sunset is, well, what if we would have met again? But again, and I say it every single week, what makes a great movie and sets it apart from every other movie is it takes a situation every single one of us has thought about and it goes there. And I say it every week, but that is the most important thing. I got to write a book about screenwriting or storytelling just called Go There, because that is what it's about. How many people think about what if I went on a train in Europe and I met a girl and that was it? And like, we had this great romantic evening. Everybody, now go there. What if we blew it because we were young and idiots? Now we get another chance. Well, go there. And what is so fascinating about when Linklater goes there, he doesn't go there the way you think he's going to go there. He always has something to pull at you that is bringing you in a different direction that you might be thinking you were originally going to go, because there's just such a brilliance to his writing. That's why, though, like, I think these movies just nail it, because he is sitting there. And remember, he's like the same age as Ethan Hawke. He's the same age as Julie Delpy. They're three really good friends at this point. And they all could experience it the same way and say, what if we did that? What if we did that? Blah, 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 blah. But they go there and they explore that conversation. And so many movies get away from exploring the conversation, exploring the idea, because they're too busy worrying about the plot, or am I going to sell tickets, or blah, blah, blah. Richard Linklater is not as popular as Paul Thomas Anderson or Wes Anderson or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But Richard Linklater has made his money, and he's made a lot of it. And he has just as strong of a fan base as those two directors from that auteur sphere.
Yeah.
And he has never done anything he didn't want to do. Ever. Mm-hmm. Ever. Everything he does, exploring time, exploring this, Boyhood, Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, Before Midnight, A Scanner Darkly, like you had said earlier, School of Rock. Even that movie is Richard Linklater-ish. And then you have Everybody Wants Some, Dazed and Confused. He is making movies where he is writing pages upon pages trying to rid something from his bones. It's all I think. I think about that line every time I watch a Richard Linklater movie. And I just think that's why Before Sunset nails it and knocks it out of the park.
Yeah, Before Sunset is just such a mature film. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really what's important. And like you said, Linklater's just going there, because his sole focus in these movies are the characters. There's no plot. You described the plot to this movie. It took you like five words scenes to describe. Yeah. And there's so much focus on these characters that even the things that go unsaid feel like they're being said.
Yep. Yep.
And that is something that really goes to show what a truly phenomenal filmmaker is, because a truly phenomenal filmmaker working with incredible talent gets those scenes and understands the subtext in all those scenes, understands the subtext of like smaller lines, like if we didn't suffer, we wouldn't learn a thing. That's a line that comes earlier in this film that really hits you. Because that's exactly, they're saying to each other, this is their suffering. They're suffering and they're learning about themselves in these 9 years. And then, but it's like, it's breezed over. And it's just like this little subtext in it. And then, you know, the further we go on and we get like the lines like, you can never replace anyone. What's lost is lost. And it's like, but this is that opportunity where you found what's lost.
Yeah.
It feels so good because this is there. It's very rare that people get to a point in life where they don't have a moment like this, mm-hmm. where they don't have a moment where they're thinking about what was lost and like where it takes them or where it could have taken them. And then to have it come up again.
Yeah.
And like, obviously, hopefully there are a lot of people, there are a lot of people who don't need to have this moment because they went with the moment in the first place. But there are a lot of people out there who are thinking, okay, how did I get here? I'm kind of miserable right now, but what can I, is there something that I missed mm-hmm. that could make it so that I'm not miserable and that I am enjoying everything that's here? And like that goes so much into what Jesse's saying about living in the moment now mm-hmm. in this movie. Because mm-hmm. when we're young, we're, especially in North America, we're berated with these ideas of always having plans, always looking to the future, figure out what you're doing. And as I've aged, I've gotten to the point where if someone asks me what I'm doing in 5 years, I'm just going to tell them, I have no idea. I don't care because I care about what I'm doing now. And it's such a natural progression for this character to get to that point. And for this conversation to happen. And it's just so relatable.
Yeah. I agree with all that. I mean, I think that you know, I think there's just a judgment that's associated with it all in North America that we have that other parts of the world don't necessarily have. There is such an impact put on or so much influence put on like success and money and title and whatever. And I remember like when we were in Greece, we met up with somebody who their whole thing was they just wanted to be a teacher and they weren't a teacher, but they wanted to be a teacher. And I remember me and my friends being like, then be a freaking teacher. Like we were on the trip and we met like 15 teachers. Like, what are you talking about? Who just happened to be, you know, vacationing here. But like, that was what it was. That was the only thing. Like, it didn't have to be something more than that. And we see that in Jesse, who went the writer route and everything is very career driven and family driven. And then we have Celine, who thinks she wants the family. And her career doesn't matter to her. It's all about, well, I want to do this and I want to do that and I want to make this change. And come on, do you not see where the world is heading? How can you say it's possibly getting better? Like all that stuff. There's so much of that that explains the differences here. And I'm just like, you know, I think about the end of the ending of these two movies. So I know we're almost at our hour and Survivor's coming on. So I'm about to bail on all of you. But the ending of these two movies – and the ending of Before Midnight. I mean, the ending of Before Midnight is devastating when they sit down next to each other at the restaurant. It's just brutal. But the ending of these two movies, just think about that. The ending of the first one, when he's sitting on the train, or she's sitting on the train, I'm sorry, and he's walking away. And that hollowness, and that, why am I on this train? Why am I not getting off this train? And him walking away. And we don't know what that means. Like, we don't know. Remember, 1995, we didn't know 2004 was even going to happen. We thought Y2K was going to kill everybody. So, like, we didn't know that they were going to get back together in some way. And then the ending. So that one is the emptiness. And the second one is, you're going to miss that plane. I know. And it just cuts to black on her dancing foolishly to Nina Simone. And it's like, those two endings are so opposite, but they're still capturing that feeling and answering that question of, should I have, or shouldn't I have, or what if I did, what if I didn't? It's answering both of them. And then Before Midnight, obviously, just like, cut your knees out from under you and is like, hey, enjoy. Oh, but I just think like the endings of these movies, that's why they're also classics. Like, everything that happens in them is obviously great, but the endings just leave you so desperately wanting to know what's going to come next. And we haven't watched anything except for two people talk to each other. That's it.
Yeah.
And you still want to know what's going to come next. What's going to come next is they're going to continue to live their ordinary lives. And that's where we hear Linklater talk about it. You know, I want to do it all through the length of a pop song. And obviously this is preluding to Boyhood and what he was able to do with that and all that stuff. But there's so much emphasis on, you're not going to get drama or excitement out of, you know, just ordinary moments. Then tell those moments better. Just make them exciting, make them more monumental. Yeah, it's easier said than done, but that's what Linklater does with all his movies. And I have Everybody Wants Some, even higher. And that movie has no conflict. And now I really want to watch also, though, and I'll throw this one out there and then I'll let you go before we go. Now I can't wait to watch The Secret in Their Eyes, because it also has a moment on a train and it's similar. And it's about a guy who, you know, misconnections and he's writing. Now I can't wait to watch that one. And unfortunately, I just looked ahead. I'm like, how many more weeks do I have? Fortunately, I put it too damn high on my ranking, so it's still a little while.
Oh, sorry. So. Yes. it's just this trilogy, I didn't know what to think going into this trilogy. I knew it was hard, highly regarded, but I didn't know it was going to hit me so hard the way that it did. And, you know, I'm kind of glad I've gotten over a Before Midnight moment at this point. Mm-hmm. So I could really appreciate that one as well. Obviously, yes, devastating movie. It's funny that you were talking about like the professionalism versus family of Jesse and Celine in Before Sunset and how it reverses. Mm-hmm. In Before Midnight is really interesting. But I don't know, these characters, what it would have been, how great it would have been to watch these movies as they released.
Mm-hmm.
And just like that experience, like I watched Before Sunrise and I was like, I could watch Before Sunset right now, but it doesn't feel right to. I had to wait a day between them. I had to wait a day between them. And I was even talking to someone this week who said that they were going to watch the Before trilogy and they're just going to watch them back to back. And I just told them, don't.
Mm-hmm.
Because you need the time to breathe. You need the time to kind of like forget so that it's all in your memory when you go visit these next films in this movie. Mm-hmm. It's what Linklater did phenomenally with them. The decision to make these 9 years apart is absolutely brilliant. It's fantastic, and we don't need another film in this movie, but I've never, or in this series, but I would never complain if another one did come out and we saw these people again.
I agree. Totally, totally agree. Great trilogy. Check it out if you haven't. And if you listened to us this whole time and you haven't, well, whoops, but check them out. Can't wait to talk about more Linklater coming up, because I do have Everybody Wants Some. I think number 15 or something like that. So very high up on my list. And we'll be talking about movies that are very inspired by this or that are similar to this. Like, I have a pretty distinct taste that starts coming up here. Yeah. But John and I, we have 3 weeks left before we take a month-long hiatus due to varying life circumstances. So we have 3 weeks remaining. And then and that's going to be a fun one on the 25th because it's Survivor finale time. But either way, we have 3 weeks remaining. And next week, we are going to Battleship Potemkin from 1925 and The Pianist from 2002. And I cannot wait to give my backstory on The Pianist and the last time I watched this movie. And this will be the first time since then, but I'm going to save that for next week because it is going to be a monumental moment in my life. And I can't wait to get it done. It's going to be a true, true full circle. So that's my spoiler I'll give you all for that. Can't wait to be back for that next week. Thank you all for watching. Thank you all for listening. Thank you all for continuing to help us get at least 120 something people who watch these every week. I don't know why you're all doing it, but you're consistently doing it. And we appreciate that. Keep spreading the word about it. If you're enjoying it, we only got 38 weeks left. So, you know, we're almost there, as crazy as that sounds. But John, thanks as always. And we'll see everybody next week.
Black Friday is bringing the sunshine and the savings with Cheap Caribbean Vacations. Right now, you can score $500 off site-wide vacation packages when you book 4 nights or more. From Cancun to Aruba to Punta Cana, your next beach vacay is calling your name. It's the perfect time to book. What are you waiting for? Go to CheapCaribbean.com and get $500 off your next vacation today.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Owning a home is full of surprises. Some wonderful, some not so much. And when something breaks, it can feel like the whole day unravels. That's why HomeServe exists. For as little as $4.99 a month, you'll always have someone to call. A trusted professional ready to help, bringing peace of mind to 4.5 million homeowners nationwide. For plans starting at just $4.99 a month, go to HomeServe.com. That's HomeServe.com.
Not available everywhere. Most plans range between $4.99 to $11.99 a month your first year. Terms apply on covered repairs.